parents nervously cracking their knuckles all the way from Florida. "You'd think they'd learn," she said to Tim, waving her arms. "Some women aren't meant to get married." She carried the box of toys to the small outbuilding she'd converted into a pottery studio. Returning to...
That's all the time we have. Thank you for joining us for the Noon Book Hour. We hope you'll join us again tomorrow for our next installment from the Recording Library of West Texas.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Music and Memories, followed by USA Today at 2.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 73 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the upper 50s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the upper 70s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
Good afternoon. Welcome to your coronavirus update for Thursday, November 19th, 2020. I'm Michael from the Recording Library of West Texas. And coming up, we'll be bringing you stories that include Oxford AstraZeneca coronavirus vaccine produces robust immune response in the elderly. Delirium may be a primary symptom of COVID-19 in older adults, study says. The dose of coronavirus you're exposed to could determine how sick you get. Powerless to stop the spread, nursing homes are seeing record levels of infections, report says. And a top U.S. official says hospitalizations and deaths will keep climbing as COVID-19 cases explode nationwide. First, we'll take a look at the numbers. From the Odessa American, editor's note, Ector County will not be able to update the COVID-19 dashboard this week due to limited data entry staff. So as of the last report, ECISD daily cases, 20 students and 8 staff. Midland County, 6,576 confirmed, 121 deaths. From the Texas Tribune, all of Texas's 254 counties have now reported at least one coronavirus case. Average new cases increased by 616 cases compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On November 18th, 8,489 new cases were reported. Hospitalizations increased by 1,179 patients compared with a week ago. As of November 18th, 7,958 Texans are hospitalized with the coronavirus. And average new deaths increased by 28 deaths compared with the 7-day average a week ago. Now here are coronavirus briefs. After witnessing its deadliest day since early May, the United States will soon have recorded more than 250,000 coronavirus fatalities. Nearly 1,900 deaths were reported on Wednesday, as the country again set a record for the number of patients hospitalized nationwide. Pfizer intends to seek emergency authorization for its experimental coronavirus vaccine within a matter of days. Infectious disease experts estimate more than 3 million people in the United States are infected with the coronavirus, the equivalent of about 1% of the population or the total number of public school teachers in the country. More than 11.5 million cases have been reported nationwide since February, according to data tracked by the Washington Post. The coronavirus is posing its most serious threat to Congress in months, at a time when inaction in Washington could cause 12 million Americans to lose unemployment benefits by the end of the year. Americans are once again lining up for hours for coronavirus tests and waiting days to get the results. The situation is probably only going to get worse as people try to get tested ahead of Thanksgiving gatherings. Another 742,000 Americans filed for unemployment claims last week, the first increase in a month. Now here are our short articles. Oxford AstraZeneca coronavirus vaccine produces robust immune response in the elderly, by the Washington Post's William Booth. The coronavirus vaccine being developed by Oxford University and the pharmaceutical powerhouse AstraZeneca produced a strong immune response in older adults, as well as in the young, studies published Thursday say. Many vaccines for other illnesses, such as seasonal flu, tend to show less effectiveness the older one gets, but clinical trial results published in The Lancet, a British medical journal, showed that test subjects over 70 who are at increased risk of hospitalization and death from the virus produced a robust immune response when given the Oxford injection. "We're delighted," said Andrew Pollard, the Oxford Vaccine Group's director. "The first data are really encouraging, showing we are getting very good immune response in the over 70s. Maheshi Ramasmy, a co-investigator at the Oxford Vaccine Group, said the vaccine is stimulating the production of both neutralizing antibodies and T cells to fight off infection. "We hope that this means our vaccine will help to protect some of the most vulnerable people in society, but further research will be needed before we can be sure," she said. AstraZeneca released similar results in an earlier news release. The Lancet paper contains the detailed data for scientists to review. Pollard said his team will probably know whether the Oxford vaccine protects people against illness in results expected before Christmas. "If the Oxford vaccine is effective," Pollard said, "that AstraZeneca would quickly seek regulatory approval and begin distributing doses. The Oxford AstraZeneca candidate has been a front-running candidate for months, but drug makers Moderna and Pfizer have pulled ahead in recent weeks, with results suggesting that their vaccines are more than 90% effective. The Pfizer and Moderna vaccines also show effectiveness in older adults, but their vaccines require deep freeze storage, while the Oxford vaccine needs an ordinary refrigerator found in pharmacies and doctor's offices. "We're not in a rush," Pollard said. "It's not a competition against other developers." Delirium may be a primary symptom of COVID-19 in older adults, study says, from CNN's Naomi Thomas. Delirium was common among elderly patients with COVID-19 who came in the emergency department, according to a study published Thursday in the JAMA Network Open, and many of them did not have other typical signs or symptoms of the disease. In this multi-center retrospective cohort study, 28% of 817 older patients with COVID-19 infection had delirium on arrival to the emergency department, and delirium was the sixth most common presenting symptom or sign overall, read the study, from lead authors Dr. Maura Kennedy of Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School, and Benjamin Helfand of the University of Massachusetts Medical School. Delirium at presentation was significantly associated with increased risk of poor hospital outcomes, including ICU stay, discharge to a rehabilitation facility, and death, the study said. Of the 226 patients with delirium, 37, or 16%, had delirium as their primary symptom. Importantly, the author said, 84 of those 226, or 37%, had no fever or shortness of breath. More on the study. The study was conducted at seven sites across the United States and included older adults who went to emergency rooms on or after March 13th. Some of the factors associated with delirium included being older than 75, living in a nursing home or assisted living facility, prior use of psychoactive medication, vision or hearing impairment, stroke, and Parkinson's disease. "Our study demonstrates that it is critical to recognize that older adults with COVID-19 may present with delirium as the primary or sole symptom," the study says. In addition, delirium is an important risk marker to identify patients at high risk for poor outcomes, including death. Remember, the study does have some limitations, including the fact that they suspect that the delirium rate observed is an underestimate. They were unable to evaluate site-specific data and enrollment occurred primarily in the Northeast during a time when it was undergoing a surge in COVID-19 infections. The dose of coronavirus you're exposed to could determine how sick you get. The U.S. just surpassed a tragic milestone of more than 250,000 coronavirus deaths and more than 11.5 million infections nationwide, according to data from Johns Hopkins. Just how bad things could get will be determined by Thanksgiving celebrations next week. Health officials have warned against traditional indoor gatherings that seem to be a big driver in the surge of cases. Each family will need to weigh the risks of celebrating Thanksgiving in person or virtually, depending on individual circumstances, as well as taking precautions like masks and hand sanitizer. Dr. Sanjay Gupta has said the dose of the virus you receive might make the difference between being asymptomatic, getting mildly sick, or becoming critically ill. It's not because you need a certain number of particles of virus to infect a cell. It just increases the odds that one of those viral particles will make it into the cell and infect it, setting off a chain reaction, he explains. Another way to think of it is, like conception, you don't need millions of sperm to fertilize an egg. You only need one. But men make millions of sperm to improve the chances that one will reach the egg, overcome its defenses, and fertilize it. Each person has a different amount of virus that they need, explains Aaron Brummage, an associate professor of biology at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. Somebody that is immunosuppressed or somebody that is stressed, for example, may need less of a virus challenge in order to get the same outcomes as somebody that is in a healthy condition, she adds. Put it all together, and the chance of infection depends on the physiology of the potential host, as well as their personal behaviors and health habits, such as smoking status, diet, physical activity, and sleep. An elderly or unhealthy host in the face of large recurrent exposures is clearly the worst-case scenario. But a medically fragile person could be sickened by even a low dose of the virus. Conversely, a healthy person can be overwhelmed with a high enough dose. Powerless to stop the spread, nursing homes are seeing record levels of infections, report says, by the Washington Post's Antonia Farzan. Despite a slew of new precautions, nursing homes are reporting record numbers of coronavirus infections, according to a new report from the American Healthcare Association and National Center for Assisted Living. The report is based on data from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which only began tracking infections at nursing homes in May, meaning that its statistics do not capture the number of people who got sick when the coronavirus raced through assisted living facilities in March. But it shows that Midwestern states have witnessed an especially dramatic surge in recent months, with the number of new cases reported in nursing homes each week increasing 200% between mid-September and early November. During the first week of November, at least 10,279 coronavirus cases were reported at nursing homes across the country, shattering the previous record of 9,903 cases in late July. The surge of infections closely tracks with nationwide trends. Nursing homes reported just shy of 6,000 new cases a week in mid-September, when infections also dropped among the general population. Since then, the numbers have been climbing steadily. Many states are again banning family members and other outside visitors from nursing homes, and federal guidelines require staffers to be tested twice a week. But the high rate of coronavirus transmission around the country means that those measures can only go so far toward preventing outbreaks, the association said. Our worst fears have come true as COVID runs rampant among the general population, and long-term care facilities are powerless to fully prevent it from entering due to its asymptomatic and pre-symptomatic spread. Mark Parkinson, the president and CEO of the AHCA and NCAL, said in a statement. A top U.S. official says hospitalizations and deaths will keep climbing as COVID-19 cases explode nationwide. From CNN's Christina Maxouris. An end to the COVID-19 pandemic may now be in sight with more good news on vaccine candidates. But for now, this will get worse, a top U.S. official said Wednesday. We have had 1 million cases documented over the past week. Our rate of rise is higher than it even was in the summer. We have hospitalizations going up 25% week over week. Admiral Brett Geer, Assistant Secretary for Health at the Department of Health and Human Services, told CNN, "There are so many more cases that we have that deaths are going up." It is what experts have repeatedly warned in the past weeks as COVID-19 conditions continue to deteriorate across the country. Things will get worse before they get better. Infection numbers in Massachusetts are 8 times what they were on Labor Day, and hospitalizations have quadrupled. Only 6% of Oklahoma's ICU beds remain available. In Arkansas, more than 1,000 people could lose their lives in the next 5 weeks, according to the governor. In Illinois, the virus is now the third leading cause of death behind heart disease and cancer. More than 250,000 Americans have so far died of the virus, a higher death toll than any other country, and another 188,000 are projected to lose their lives over the next 3.5 months, according to the University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation. By mid-January, the IHME model predicts more than 2,100 Americans could be dying daily. As you've heard so many times before, we know how to fix this, Geer told CNN Wednesday night. It's all about absolute adherence to wearing a mask, avoiding crowds, and yes, we can keep the economy open, but we're going to have to diminish indoor places like indoor dining and restaurants. And that is your coronavirus update for this Thursday, November 19th, 2020, from the Recording Library of West Texas. I'm Michael. Coming up, we'll bring you a health magazine to take us up to 2 o'clock, at which time we'll bring you USA Today with national news. And then at 3 o'clock, our local news broadcast. Here's some of the articles our volunteers are reading today. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, crisis puts stress on finite number of physicians. Sales tax shows another 20%+ decline. Foo files lawsuit against Chinese billionaire. From the Odessa American, attendance and substitute teachers down at ECISD. Texas church hero speaks at luncheon. And Andrews students report back to class. Those articles and more at 3 o'clock. At 6 o'clock, more news from the Wall Street Journal. And then at 7 o'clock, we'll bring you the first of our broadcasts over the weekend of Texas Monthly Archives. Today, we'll be reading about something that unfortunately has stained Texas and Dallas in particular for decades. We are going to look back at the November 22nd, 1963 day. And we will have several articles related to the people and the events of that time. That's on Texas Monthly Archives coming up at 7 o'clock tonight. We'll be back tomorrow afternoon at 1 o'clock. Thank you very much for joining us. Be well and stay safe. Have a great day.
This program is made available to the IAAIS Program Share and was recorded at the Audio Reading Service of the Ellen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana, for people with print impairments.
Welcome. This is Healthy Life, and I'm your reader, Tony Ray, with the Audio Reading Service at the Ellen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today I'll be reading from Health, and I'll begin with a few short articles to help inspire you. Potato power. Spuds sometimes get a bad rap for being so starchy, heavier on the carbs, but they are actually high in vitamins, minerals, and antioxidants and fiber. What is more, researchers from McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, recently published a study that showed that the protein in potatoes helps young women build and maintain strong muscles. While women didn't eat tons of spuds, they had isolated potato protein added to their diets. This is good news for the future of food. It shows that plant-based proteins are similar in quality to meat proteins. If an abundant source like potatoes can provide a high-quality protein, then we have a lot to be thankful for. Barefoot workouts. When gyms closed down across the country this spring, many of us turned to home workouts, which brings up the question, if you're not leaving the house, do you need to wear shoes to exercise? We asked Yolanda Raglan, MD, podiatrist, reconstructive surgeon, and founder of CEO of Fix Your Feet, for her input. Can exercising while barefoot be beneficial? Exercising while barefoot can definitely be advantageous to your feet, says Dr. Raglan. Engaging in low-impact exercises barefoot on forgiving surfaces like sand and grass or a cushioned mat over hard wood can bolster muscular structures that surround the bones, promoting outer joint stability and maintaining inner joint integrity and motion. Reinforcing foot fitness will promote balance, improving the alignment of the muscular and bony structures of the foot. When do sneakers matter? Sneakers provide shock absorption, which protects bones from breaking and aching, says Dr. Raglan. They lend arch support to preserve the plantar fascia, eliminating heel pain from plantar fasciitis. Shoes shield our soles from sharp objects and cover the tops of our feet, safeguarding them from projectiles that can fall from above. The verdict? Yoga is the perfect exercise to perform without shoes, but impact exercises like jump squats or mountain climbers are best with shoes or, if without shoes, done on forgiving terrain while limiting the number of repetitions and sets. Heads Up, a story by Sunny Seagold. About strokes. Experts say strokes are becoming more common in younger people. Here's what they want you to know to keep your brain safe. Nearly 800,000 Americans have a stroke each year. That's one person every 40 seconds. A stroke happens when a blood vessel to the brain is either blocked or ruptures, starving the organ of the oxygen and nutrients it needs to function. If the part of the brain that controls speech or vision is cut off from nourishment, for example, the person may not be able to speak or see normally. If the brain is deprived of oxygen for too long, it can lead to death or permanent problems such as memory issues, trouble speaking, or understanding language, and paralysis. In fact, stroke is the leading cause of serious long-term disability in this country. And stroke victims are getting younger, says B.J. Hicks II, M.D., vascular neurologist and co-director of the Comprehensive Stroke Center at Ohio State Riverside Methodist Hospital in Columbus. In just the past decade, the number of young adults hospitalized with stroke in the U.S. has increased by 44%. Gone are the days when I was surprised to see a stroke patient under the age of 40 or even 30, says Hicks. We are seeing strokes from classic risk factors, such as hypertension, diabetes, high cholesterol, in younger populations. More recently, in the past 8 months, a small number of COVID-19 patients in their 30s and 40s have become disabled or died as a result of stroke, likely because of increased blood clotting caused by the virus. That's bad news, but there is some good news, too. Stroke is treatable when it's caught early, and many cases are actually entirely preventable. The vast majority of strokes are the type that involve a blockage of blood flow to the brain, also known as ischemic stroke. Most of the time, the blockage is caused by a clot that forms at the fatty plaque within a blood vessel. High blood pressure typically causes the other type of stroke called hemorrhagic. Hypertension puts extra stretch on the lining of the blood vessels, which can make them more likely to burst. Viral infections can also bring on strokes. Doctors have known for decades that both HIV and the virus that causes shingles can lead to stroke in the months or years after infection. They cause an inflammatory response within the blood vessels that cause them to narrow. The mechanism behind COVID-19-related strokes is somewhat different. COVID can cause the formation of blood clots a few weeks after the infection begins, which can then disrupt blood flow to the brain. One of the most persistent myths about stroke is that it's not treatable, says Matthew Fiesta, MD, a neurointerventional radiologist at Texas Health Harris Methodist Hospital, Fort Worth. The reality is that people who make it to the hospital within 4.5 hours of developing symptoms may be given a drug that dissolves blood clots, called tissue plasminogen activator, TPA. Patients who get the medication tend to have less disability. Over the past 5 to 6 years, stroke treatment has advanced by leaps and bounds, says Dr. Fiesta. For example, within the first 24 hours after stroke symptoms appear, doctors can now perform a mechanical thrombectomy. It's a minimally invasive procedure in which a long catheter is inserted from the arm or leg up to physically remove the blockage brain vessel and restore blood flow. While stroke treatment has made great strides, every second that your brain is starved of oxygen is critical. So, ideally, you want to lower your risk factors to prevent stroke altogether. The first step is to make sure you know your risk factors, says Fiesta. Schedule regular checkups with your primary care physician to track your blood pressure and cholesterol. If you suspect you might have an abnormal heart rhythm, mention it. Atrial fibrillation is a common cause of stroke. And investigate your family history. Genetics can play a large role in other illnesses that increase stroke risk. There's a lot you can do on a daily basis, too. Up to a whopping 80% of strokes could be avoided through healthy lifestyle behavior, according to the CDC. That is a jaw-dropping statistic most people are not aware of, says Fiesta. Because of the most common strokes are due to plaque buildup in the arteries, anything that's good for your cardiovascular health will lower stroke risk, too. That means getting at least 2.5 hours of moderate exercise a week and eating plenty of fiber. Consuming 25 grams a day can help prevent high cholesterol. You might also want to cut back on the booze. Although red wine may have potential benefits for the heart, alcohol does raise blood pressure levels and the amount of triglycerides, type of plaque-causing fat, in your blood. Docs recommend that women have more than one drink a day and men no more than two. Stroke, like so many of the other serious health conditions, is also linked to increased stress. With a pandemic, political clashes, and economic worries, we are all under incredible strain. One of the most important things you can do right now is take care of your mental and emotional wellness. Be sure to make time for pleasure, mindfulness, connection, and relaxation. Anything that helps you feel more hopeful about your world. How to spot a stroke. When your brain's blood supply is interrupted, there's zero time to waste. That's why the American Stroke Association came up with FAST, an acronym for the telltale signs, so you can recognize them right away and get to the ER stat. F. Face drooping. Does one side of your face droop, or is your smile lopsided or uneven? A. Arm weakness. Hold your arms above your head. Does one drip down? S. Speech. Is your speech slurred? Are you having a hard time saying simple phrases correctly? Are you unable to speak? T. Time to call 911. Any of these symptoms, even if they're temporary, are a reason to seek help immediately. Other common signs include a sudden loss of balance, numbness, confusion, trouble seeing in one or both eyes, and sudden severe headache. So I'll go over those one more time. F for face drooping, A, arm weakness, S for speech, T, time to call 911. So just remember, FAST. It's a great acronym. Rebalancing the Gut by Megan Rabbit. It seems extreme, but when GI bacteria are seriously out of whack, a fecal transplant, yep, you read that right, may work wonders. Barbara Wyatt was willing to do anything to fix her chronic stomach problems. For nearly a year, she had nausea so often that she had to drive to work with a bag in her lap. She also lost her appetite and had diarrhea every day. Eventually, Watt was diagnosed with Clostridioides difficile, also aka SC period DIFF, diff, a potentially deadly bacterial infection that causes inflammation of the colon. She was likely infected during a hospital stay, as many C. diff patients are. Hers was for a knee replacement. Wyatt took two rounds of powerful antibiotic, the gold standard treatment for C. diff, but after the drug failed to help, her doc said there was only one other option left to try, a fecal transplant. It sounded crazy and gross, said the former insurance agent from Fishers, Indiana, but I was so sick that I thought, if this cures me, I'm okay with it. Over the past decade, fecal microbiotic transplantation, FMT, has slowly become more mainstream. Here's how it works. Stool from a healthy donor is transferred into a patient's colon via a colonoscopy, endoscopy, edema, or capsules. Only stool donated before the novel coronavirus pandemic is used, and it's screened for pathogens and processed for medical use. The idea is that the donor's stool is filled with healthy mix of bacteria and other microbes that will make a new home in the patient's GI tract, ultimately correcting the imbalance that has led to the patient's symptoms, says Ari Grinspan, MD, associate professor of gastroenterology and director of FMT program at the Icahn School of Medicine in Mount Sinai in New York. The gut microbiome is an incredibly complex network of microorganisms that play an important role in maintaining your health. Medications like antibiotics or underlying conditions like inflammatory bowel disease, IBD, can disrupt the balance of those microorganisms. Sometimes these changes can lead to serious issues like C. diff infections. While scientists are still trying to figure out how exactly bacteria from one person's microbiome can help heal someone else's, the most likely explanation is that a handful of the bacteria in the donor's stool seed the patient's diseased colon and start to flourish, says Dr. Grinspan. We think that kickstarts the patient's own healthy bacteria to become more diverse and abundant. Especially the bacteria causing the problem are overrun by new healthy boosting organisms, he says. Plenty of research has backed up the treatment. In a landmark study published in 2013 in the New England Journal of Medicine, fecal transplant was shown to work better than antibiotics. In following years, more and larger studies confirmed that result, prompting the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to consider FTM as an investigational new drug for treating current C. diff infections that did not respond to standard therapies. Today, the success rate for fecal transplant is higher than 87%. FTM hasn't yet been approved for any condition other than C. diff, but that may change soon, as scientists are studying fecal transplants to treat everything from obesity and autism to Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. Researchers are also hopeful FMT may help cure other gut disorders such as Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, though more studies are needed to prove that it helps in a majority of cases. For now, tens of thousands of patients with C. diff have been cured thanks to FMT. Many of them, including Wyatt, start to feel better within days. I'm so glad I got past the initial shock of what was involved in the procedure itself, because it worked like magic. To think a total stranger's poop helped me get back to living normally again, I still can't believe it. And now, a few stories from Personal Best. Dr. Zobra's Corner. Should I wear a mask? The answer is yes, for two reasons. First, a mask will help you keep from spreading COVID-19 if you have it. You can be infectious and not have symptoms. Masks cut down dramatically on respiratory droplets that spread the virus. Second, wearing a mask helps keep you from touching your nose, mouth, and eyes, where COVID-19 can enter. And, combined with hand washing and staying at least 6 feet away from other people, social or physically distancing, it's recommended way to keep you and others healthy. Note, masks are not a substitute for social distancing or hand washing. Wash your mask daily and don't touch the front. Understanding cancer. Know the facts and your personal risks. About one in every three Americans will develop cancer. Fortunately, our ability to survive cancer has improved significantly thanks to a growing knowledge of many cancer types, advancing surgical procedures and medications, and early detection. The death rate from all cancers combined declined by 29% in 1991 to 2017. The decline is largely due to fewer deaths from lung cancer, which remains the nation's leading cause of cancer deaths in men and women. Many other common cancers are on a gradual decline, too. Liver cancer is the exception. Cases in the U.S. have more than tripled since 1930, while the death rates have been more than doubled during this time. For men, the overall rate of new cancer cases has stabilized through 2016 due to a gradual decline in colorectal cancer and stabilizing prostate cancer cases. For women, the overall rate of new cancer cases has stabilized during the past decades. Lung and colorectal cases are down slightly, while other cancers common in women have increased or stayed the same. Breast cancer rates have increased slightly since 2004 due to, in part, to increased obesity. Prevention. Cancer treatment is most successful when the disease is found early. Discuss cancer screening with your provider. What scientists have confirmed about cancer prevention is still evolving. The Harvard School of Public Health has estimated that up to 75% of cancer deaths in the United States can be prevented through lifestyle choices. Kick tobacco of all kinds. It remains the leading cause of cancer. Stay lean. Obesity has become the second leading risk factor after smoking for many types of cancer. Overweight and obesity are now linked with 13 types of cancer, which accounted for about 40% of all cancers. If you drink alcohol, use moderation. Excess alcohol can cause cancer of the larynx, esophagus, liver, colon, rectum, and female breasts, among others. Choose a Mediterranean food plan. It offers plenty of fruits and vegetables, whole grains and legumes, plus seafood, plus limits meat. Exercise routinely. It may reduce the risk of colon and breast tumors. Always use sunscreen outdoors. Skip tanning beds and avoid intense sun between 10 and 4. Well, did you know that there are 5 red flags of housing rental scams? Look for a great place to rent. Scammers are looking, too, for people like you. According to the FTC, scammers often advertise rentals that don't exist or hijacking existing rentals. Sometimes the key to spotting to these is the old adage, if it seems too good to be true, it probably isn't. For example, a listing is priced way below the current average market for similar houses or apartments in the same locale. Here are the actual red flags. The rental company tells you to wire money. There is no good reason to wire money, even if the company sends you a contract first. They want a security deposit or your first month's rent before you've met or signed a lease. They ask for personal information such as a driver's license or social security number before you've seen the place to process the application. They say they are out of the country or on vacation and can't show you the property, but say they have a plan to get you the keys. Some even send fake keys. They either provide no photos or the photos have MLS watermarks, which could mean the scammer is using images of properties that are being sold. Report rental scams to FTCOMPLAINTassistant.gov. Well, here's a workplace safety quiz. Are you safety savvy when it comes to workplace crime prevention? True or false? Working at home doesn't shield you from scam attempts. True or false? The answer is true. Keep an eye out for email or phone scammers. Never leave valuables unattended or unsecured, even in a secure building. The answer is true. Always lock up valuables or take them with you. And number three, when visitors enter your workplace, let them find their own way to their destination. True or false? False. Check with the identity of visitors to your workplace. Number four, when a coworker sends you a chain email to pass along to other coworkers, immediately delete the email from opening any links. True or false? True. Email viruses are typically passed through chain emails. And the last one, if working from home, keep your windows clear so you can see who is coming or going from your home. True or false? False. While you should keep bushes and trees trimmed so you can see into your yard, you should always hang window treatments to obstruct the view into your office. You don't want thieves seeing your expensive office equipment. Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Tony Ray with Healthy Life. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service of the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
To bring us up to time for our next regularly scheduled program, we now bring you the following informative feature.
This program is made available to the IAAIS program share and was recorded at the audio reading service of the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana, for people with print impairments.
Welcome, this is Book Reviews. I'm your reader, Bonnie Weiss, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today I'll be reading from the Fort Wayne Journal Gazette, beginning with I Before We. Progressive Movement Offers Template for American Renewal. As the nation limps into Tuesday's general election, toxins perpetuated by political and social polarization define the air we breathe. Poisonous posts dotting social media are perhaps only outdone by TV ads, rarely rising above ad hominem attacks. Swirling amid those toxins, however, are messages to the contrary. Social commentators and even some politicians point out what we are experiencing is nothing new, and when needed, Americans found a way to respond. Two such commentators are Robert D. Putnam and Shailen Romney Garrett Putnam, a research professor at Harvard University, has challenged the rising level of those toxins with frequency over the course of a distinguished career through titles such as Bowling Alone in 2000, Better Together 2003, American Grace 2010, and Our Kids 2015. In his most recent effort to revive America's spirit of community, Putnam is joined by Garrett. Beyond being commended for their hopeful message, Putnam and Garrett demonstrate wisdom, emerging from what they refer to as an exercise in macro history. As a result, the upswing confirms Americans can build back better or make America great again. Defining the upswing is what Putnam and Garrett referred to as the I-we-I curve. In essence, they mine the depths of existing data to determine how the sense of community shared by Americans has changed over time. The result is the I-we-I curve, which traces a fundamental arc of social change in America over the course of the last 125 years, an arc whose influence seeped into the most varied nooks and crannies of American life. That arc reaches back to an era in American life plagued by the toxins of political and social polarization as great as our own, the Gilded Age, or last quarter of the 1800s. In response to excesses wrought by the spirit of individualism that dominated that age, Putnam and Garrett note American life, as led by groups of progressive reformers, was defined as a gradual climb into greater interdependence and cooperation. That climb would last through the mid to late 1960s, when the data Putnam and Romney reviewed point to a steep descent into greater independence and egoism. As few would likely argue to the contrary, Putnam and Romney view the behavior presently being exhibited as examples of what that steep descent can yield. As previously noted, however, the result of their work is hopeful. In essence, if Americans could successfully weather the excesses of the Gilded Age, we can do it again. The bulk of that hopeful message is defined by data collected over 125 years in four key areas: economics, politics, society, and culture. Historians may quickly note the 1960s was an era in which considerable gains were made, for example, in civil rights. Putnam and Romney agree legislation such as the Civil Rights Acts of 1964, 1965, and 1968 were monumental. Their macro view of history, however, also compels them to contend the conditions making those legislative efforts possible were forged over the course of the previous 50 years. For example, they contend African Americans made gains in those four key areas at a faster rate prior to the 1960s than since that time. As a result, Putnam and Garrett argue that as America took a more individualistic and narcissistic turn after 1970, we simultaneously took our foot off the gas in pushing toward true racial equality. While Putnam and Garrett are enamored with efforts made by progressive reformers, they are also quick to note that present circumstances defy the mere replication of those efforts. While Americans seeking to build back better or make America great again can take hope from those efforts, Putnam and Garrett encourage them to chart reforms attuned to the particulars of the present moment. Regardless of what they chart, Putnam and Garrett contend the success of those reforms, the ability of we to be the next in the I-we-I curve, is predicated upon the ability of those two groups and many others to work together. Next, new library books. The following works of sibling fiction are newly available through the Allen County Public Library. Girl Minus X by Anne Stone. 15-year-old Danny is trying to survive with her little sister Mac in a world collapsing under the weight of a slow, creeping virus that erodes memory. When a new and more virulent strain of the disease emerges and Danny begins to experience symptoms, the sisters are cast into crisis. The Once and Future Witches by Alex E. Harrell. In the late 1800s, three sisters use witchcraft to change the course of history in this powerful novel of magic and the suffragist movement. A Saint from Texas by Edmund White. A bold and sweeping new novel that traces the extraordinary fates of twin sisters born on a humble patch of East Texas prairie, one destined for Parisian nobility and the other for Catholic sainthood. The Boy in the Field by Margot Livesey. Saving the life of a young boy, three siblings find their bond challenged by their parents' troubled marriage and their respective efforts to identify the boy's attacker, manage a new relationship, and search for a birth parent. Sisters by Daisy Johnson. Moving in the aftermath of a school bullying incident to an abandoned family home near the shore, two fiercely loyal siblings find the nature of their bond changing in the wake of a series of revelatory encounters. Rescue You by Alicia Whistler. rehabilitating pit bulls into war veteran companions. Sisters Constance and Sunny are targeted by a vindictive neighbor before making unexpected self-discoveries and bonding with a group of ex-military friends at a local gym where the owner is battling PTSD. The following reviews are from Kirkus Book Reviews. American Crisis, Leadership Lessons from the COVID-19 Pandemic by Andrew Cuomo. The governor of New York recounts his battle against the pandemic and at every step, the Trump administration. The COVID virus is not the extent of our problem, writes Cuomo. COVID merely exposed underlying weaknesses. While describing how he and his colleagues fought the virus and mountains of misguided information from the White House, the author inserts points of progressive doctrine. State governments must reinvent the public health capacity, and anecdotal memories of his father, also a renowned governor of New Deal leanings. Not term-limited and already in his 10th year on the job, Cuomo writes, "I intend to serve as governor of New York as long as the people will have me." He has emerged from the pandemic as one of the few leaders who guided his state through the storm, if at great cost, while his bugaboo, Trump, emerges as inept throughout. He's a marketing man, a cockroach-like survivor, Cuomo suggests, but not who you want to deal with a crisis that involves trusting science, data, and the government. Though structured as a diary of the plague, beginning with a patient zero, who brought the virus not from China, but Europe, and extending to the near present, Cuomo's book is really an extended assertion, unabashedly liberal, that government has a duty to act in the public good, as well as a set of prescriptions for making government better when it cannot or will not do so, as, Cuomo alleges, the Trump administration did when it threw its hands up to abandon its basic role of managing a federal emergency. That failure, though, allowed Cuomo to pivot as needed, and as he observes, New York's economy is now three quarters open, and the infection rate has been far lower than most other places after the initial onslaught. An engaging, maddening record of how to and how not to manage a crisis. Next, What My Mother and I Don't Talk About. 15 Writers Break the Silence. Edited by Michelle Philgate. 15 essayists, many luminaries, write unflinchingly about their mothers. From the first page of the introduction, where editor Philgate, an MFA student at NYU and contributing editor at Literary Hub, names cooking as a way of staying connected to the mother she doesn't talk to very often, this collection is honest and riveting. Kaisi Lehman writes about the difference between loving someone and loving how that someone makes you feel, while Carmen Maria Machado explores how her feelings about the mother from whom she's estranged shape her thoughts about having or not having children herself. In her sharp contribution, Lynn Steger Strong, considers what she cannot find a way to say about the anger she feels toward her mother. Juliana Baggett describes being her mother's confessor. Andre Assaman ruminates about his mother's deafness, and that also serves as odes to language and bodies and communication. Brandon Taylor illuminates the experience of cancer and examines his lack of empathy for his mother. And Leslie Jameson rounds out the collection with a loving piece in which she attempts to project my admiration back through time to reassure the woman my mom had been, that woman who felt only that she had somehow failed the man who loved her first, that woman who did not know, could not have known, the road ahead. Most of the essays are pointedly literary and lyrical. Many include meta-reflections on the nature of truth-telling, and the narrators show themselves thinking and rethinking the claims they hazard and then revise about their mothers. For the most part, the collection avoids cliché and sentimentality. Equally remarkable, each one of these intimate and gut-wrenching essays reaches beyond itself to forge connections with readers. Other contributors include Alexander Chi, Melissa Phoebos, and Sari spot on. Moving Mother's Day reading for the fearless and brave, though some readers may want to have their therapist on speed dial. Our next review, Bitter River by Julia Keller. A tough prosecutor in a small West Virginia town battles criminals and inner demons. Belle Elkins grew up poor in Acres Gap, made a success of her life against all odds, married a local boy, made good, and moved on to a high-paying job in Washington before giving it all up and returning to her mountain town. Now her teen daughter is living with her father in D.C. after her involvement with one of Belle's cases almost proved the death of her. Belle, who loves her job and her beautiful, dirt-poor hometown, is waiting hopefully for her sister, who killed their father in order to protect Belle, to come back home after her release from prison. While she waits, she and her friend, Sheriff Nick Fogelsong, have a tough case to solve. The murder of a promising high school student, Lucinda Trimble, who refused to give up her unborn baby. Lucinda's mother is a flower child who ekes out a living selling folk art to tourists. Her father, a high school bad boy, always in trouble, who still cares for the daughter he deserted years ago. The high school sweetheart Lucinda was set to marry becomes a suspect, along with the members of his disapproving family. Meanwhile, Belle's latest romantic interest loses a leg when the town's popular restaurant is blown to smithereens. Accident? Bomb? Killing several of her friends. And she must cope with an old friend, a former CIA interrogator who needs to spend some time in a peaceful setting, but may be bringing his dangerous past with him. A worthy follow-up to Belle's debut, A Killing in the Hills, a literate, gritty, character-driven tale with another surprise ending. Next, Signal Grace by T.M. Yeats. Daughter remembers her father as memory combines with love and forgiveness to create a touching debut memoir. Yeats, now in her early 30s, tells it like it is. Her family split by divorce, which happened when she was three, and geography. She grew up yearning for connection. She and her father never managed to be close, as fathers and daughters are supposed to be, she recalls. We didn't giggle together or share little jokes. We didn't really even see each other that often. Her parents separately lived in various United States cities, and her father's army career meant international postings as well. Yeats lived with her mother and younger brother, and she called her dad Michael. When he was gone, I couldn't think of him as dad because it hurt too much to miss him. Her yearn for a connection intensified when she lived with her father during her senior year at Incarnate Word High School in San Antonio, Texas. After her own brief marriage, while still a student at Texas A&M, and it violently blew up, her father helped her file legal protection orders. But she still felt alone. I had quite simply no idea what constituted a good man. Despite the chaos, which Yeats describes in graceful, readable prose, she began noticing hopeful signs. There is a name. Catholics call it a signal grace. It's a sign that God's listening to you and directing you all the time. You see these moments by the grace of God. It indicates that you're on the right path and that God is helping and guiding you. Her sign is a shamrock, and after Michael's death in 2010, unexpected shamrock sightings comforted her. I was flooded over and through by gratitude and forgiveness. They rinsed away the grime of mistakes and judgment like a baptism, and made me feel radiant in flowing peace. Cynics might be quick to lump this life story in with the recent glut of early age memoirs, but better than most, this story achingly portrays a family suffered by divorce and encourages the healing of hearts. Yeats keeps a strict focus on the father-daughter dynamic, and the signal grace idea is only brought toward the end, so it shouldn't deter casual irreligious readers. A well-crafted, compelling account of how one confused little girl grew up and learned to live with her past by seeing signs of God's grace. Next, The Martian by Andy Weir. When a freak dust storm brings a manned mission to Mars to an unexpected close, an astronaut who is left behind fights to stay alive. This is the first novel from software engineer Weir. One minute, astronaut Mark Watney was with his crew, struggling to make it out of a deadly Martian dust storm and back to the ship, currently in orbit over Mars. The next minute, he was gone, blown away, with an antenna sticking out his side. The crew knew he'd lost pressure in his suit, and they'd seen his bio signs go flat. In grave danger themselves, they made an agonizing but logical decision. Figuring Mark was dead, they took off and headed back to Earth. As it happens, though, due to a bizarre chain of events, Mark is very much alive. He wakes up some time later to find himself stranded on Mars with a limited supply of food and no way to communicate with Earth or his fellow astronauts.